CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchel with Neil Langto. The book is The Approaching Storm. This is progressivism at the beginning of the 20th century. Roosevelt, Wilson, and Adams define progressivism between them. They're at odds over the first war, but really over the style of governance that Wilson practices, which is a one-man think tank, and the style of government that Roosevelt proposes, which is a one-man cavalry charge, and the style of government that Jane Addams is pleased to advance, which is peace. Peace is better than war. No matter the issues, we can settle this. The mass murder that they're witnessing in Europe in 1916, the Battle of the Somme alone undermines the ability of Great Britain to produce a generation for the next 50 years. That's how bad things have become in the summer of 16. However, the election is decided in the last days by speechifying and by loyalty of the Democrats. It isn't resolved until the California votes are finally all in. And with a few thousand difference between them, the Electoral College goes to Wilson. He is now reelected President of the United States. The inauguration won't be till the late winter of 1917. So there are months here. Wilson is the president-elect and the Wilson and the president at the same time. Neil, this is the time for a peace note from Wilson. He sends one to all warring parties on December 18th. What has happened that he moves towards a peace note, now associating himself with the pacifists? And what is in that note that he hopes will be action?
Well, a little background is important to understand this. By the fall of 1916, the Germans pretty much understood that they cannot win a long war. So what they're hoping to do is find a way to end the war fairly soon, ideally with them still in the lead, because at this point they probably were winning the war, had certainly had more territory. So the thing of the way to get the war won and ended is to use the Americans as a way to bring the parties together and then get lost. They don't want the Americans actually in the peace conference. They want them just to be sort of a force to bring the both sides together. If the Americans can't do this, the Germans are pretty much openly saying, we are going to resume the unrestricted submarine warfare that we had backed down from because of the Sussex incident. And the Kaiser is even cheeky enough to even send a letter across the ocean in English, because he spoke English fluently, that he wants Wilson to see, basically stating this in fairly bald terms, saying, we're going to be forced to reconsider our submarine policy if peace does not come soon. So Wilson, after he gets elected, knows that there's a good chance the Germans are going to resume this submarine warfare, and that's going to bring America into the war. So he really feels a sense of urgency that there's got to be some sort of effort now, finally, to end the war. And this is what Jane Addams and her group had been pushing him to do for 2 years. Now he's finally ready to do it in the fall of 1916, late 1916, although people like House are telling him, don't do it, it's not time. And Lansing, his Secretary of State, is the same way, saying this is not the time to do it. But Wilson forges ahead. He's going to do this peace note. He's going to do it. And he floats this in mid-December to both sides. And he's basically saying, aren't there some things that the two of you can agree upon? You know, you both believe that each side is trying to destroy you. Can't we basically trying to encourage them to find some way to start talking? The problem was that both sides had spent so much, both in blood and treasure, that they just were not particularly interested in what Wilson was offering. Particularly, obviously, the Allies were incensed by this. They did not want Wilson doing this. They felt it was not the time to be doing it, and they felt this was only because Wilson was afraid of how the Americans might get involved. But as it turned out, neither side really jumped at Wilson's peace move. But it wasn't enough for him to give up, because about a month later, he gave the famous peace without victory speech, where he basically was saying, we in America have a right to have some say in this peace when it comes. And the peace that does come should be a good peace. It should be a peace without victory. Played very well in the United States. Again, did not play very well in Europe, particularly among the Allies.
There's a new foreign minister in Berlin. His name is Zimmerman. And in late January of 1917, Johann von Bernstorff, the German ambassador in Washington, learns that there is a decision in Berlin to return to unrestricted submarine warfare, meaning all vessels approaching England will be attacked by the submarines. He conveys this to the White House early. However, everybody will learn about it in the next days in the headlines. It is a crisis moment again, because now all the notes, all the peace gestures have come to naught. However, Neil, I got the sense that Wilson was trying to survive that, that he might have survived the shock of unrestricted submarine warfare, that Congress wasn't yet ready to join in declaring war. Is that accurate? Did it require the Zimmerman problem to push everybody over the line?
I think he was still very ambivalent, and I think much of the country was ambivalent. Yes, the Germans had behaved very badly. Yes, Americans had been killed. The question, of course, came, was this a threat to our national security? I don't think anyone was quite sure how to answer that question. Was it worth putting America into this horrible bloodbath that was slaughtering, as you mentioned, a whole generation of young men? So I think that was really haunting Wilson at the time. You know, I think if there had been a way, some way to avoid going to war, I think he would have taken it. But I also think by early 1917, when all these things are snowballing, he had come to also a belief that the United States has to be involved in this war if we are to have any say in the future peace. And it's funny because Roosevelt had been saying that since 1914, that, you know, basically say if Wilson thinks America's going to have any say in the peace conference and we don't fight, he's delusional, pretty much. So I think Wilson had come to feel that was the case himself. And there's a scene in the book where Jane Addams comes to the White House to talk to Wilson, and he tells her, she's trying to convince him, find a way to peace. There's got to be some way. And he says to her that if we don't go to war, I'd be lucky to get into the peace conference through a crack in the door. And that's totally unacceptable to him. He feels that he and America must play a role in the peace and in the future of the world, basically.
There is a response by Wilson to the news of the unrestricted submarine warfare that illustrates that we're dealing with another century, another two centuries here. He talks about preserving or protecting white civilization. And Neil, often in your book, you cite Wilson's segregationist opinions. He was not a Southerner. His father was from Ohio. His mother was from England. But he adopted the Southernist disdain for anyone who wasn't his understanding of civilized. And that includes all of the non-white races at the time. So we're dealing with a man who was, all while heeding to progressivism, is an antique to us today, an unacceptable language. Did you find that often in reading over his notes that he veered into that hate language of the 19th century?
I can't say I encountered it that much, but I certainly did encounter it. There's certainly words he used in speeches, which I talk about in the book. You know, his wife also, they were not shy about using racial slurs, which would be considered to be obviously abhorrent in the 21st century. And even in the 20th century, they were considered to be a little not particularly acceptable. But, you know, I always say Wilson grew up in the Civil War in Virginia. His family had slaves. And I don't think he ever got past that mindset. It's not to excuse his behavior, but it's perhaps to explain a little bit of it. And there's a very poignant scene in the book from 1914, when William Monroe Trotter, the editor, the African American editor of the newspaper, Boston newspaper, comes to the White House to basically confront Wilson about the segregation in the federal jobs, and it's all recorded because they had a stenographer recording everything that was said. It's quite interesting, and Trotter tries to explain to him, this is segregation is saying that we're not equal to you, that we're not your brother, you know. trying to educate Wilson about this. And Wilson's basically saying, well, if you take offense to it, that's just, you know, that's just you're creating friction between the races. And he just could not seem to grasp that point. On the other hand, you occasionally see signs of like a light bulb going off, because at one point he does speak out against some sort of racial, I think it was a lynching of some kind. Wilson did speak out against that. But in general, his views were, as I said, quite 19th century Civil War in his views. He was not as bad as some real extremists at the time. I mean, there were some Southern congressmen represented from the Deep South who were far, far worse than Woodrow Wilson. But on the other hand, he's a world away from Jane Addams, who was involved in the NAACP and was, you know, was opposed violently to the Birth of a Nation controversial racist film. Roosevelt, I'd probably situate him in the middle, certainly not as bad as Wilson, but certainly not as advanced as someone like Jane Addams. And Jane Addams was certainly far from typical of the American mindset on race. I'd say Roosevelt was probably, that's the way most white Americans thought about African-Americans and people of other ethnicities at the time.
The book is The Approaching Storm, Roosevelt, Wilson, Addams, and Their Clash Over America's Future. Neil Langto is the author. And when we come back, The Zimmerman Telegram and the Declaration of War by Congress. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.